We continue now with our look at that icon of the Pacific Northwest, the salmon, and its likely demise as we chat with David Montgomery, a professor of geomorphology at the University of Washington. He's the author of King of Fish, The Thousand-Year Run of Salmon. Beginning in Chapter 9, on page 178, you got to tell the story about Lonesome Larry, and it is so well written. It's such a hoot. Well, it's a hoot in one way. It's very funny in one way. In another way, it's like, you know, heartbreaking. So you tell the story.
I guess it's a sad hoot, but it's... Well, I'll read you the passage, and I can tell you the context.
Okay.
In 1992, a sockeye salmon named Larry swam from the sea, heading home to Idaho's Redfish Lake, up and over fish ladders at 13 dams without eating. Like his ancestors, Larry traveled upstream at an average rate of 1 to 2 miles an hour, hugging the banks in water generally less than 30 feet deep. In the 1890s, thousands of sockeye made this journey up the Columbia and then the Snake River to return to Redfish Lake. Lonesome Larry was the only sockeye that made it back to Redfish Lake in 1992. Since he came alone, the National Marine Fisheries Service had a surprise waiting for him. Instead of a nice female to spawn with, he was clubbed on the head and had his sperm squeezed out of him by technicians to fertilize hatchery fish from which the agency hoped to revive his kind. Larry himself, the last wild Redfish Lake sockeye salmon, ended up as a display on the wall of a museum managed by a dam construction company that built many of the dams that Larry swam over.
Can you just imagine this? Larry, what are you doing this weekend? I'm going to spawn and I'm going to get me some. And what he gets is a conch on the head.
What a bad surprise, eh?
Oh, my God. Not what he was expecting.
No.
Oh, that's just absolutely brutal the way you tell that. And you took a pilgrimage with your dog, Xena. You went up to check him out, didn't you?
Well, I actually spent a month in Boise, Idaho, writing the book when I was sort of in the middle of trying to think, can I actually finish this project? And it turned out that Larry was on display in a museum not two blocks from where my office was at the University of Idaho. So I made a special pilgrimage to go over and see Larry, because having driven from Seattle all the way up the Columbia River, I'd sort of followed in his footsteps and had to go see where he was.
Can we get a sense of what he went through? I mean, a lot of dams, or how did he? What happened exactly? How did he get there? What did he have to overcome to get to where you got with an easy drive?
He had to overcome a whole series of dams.
Like 9 dams or something like that?
Something like that. And most of them, they all have fish ladders, so there was a way for him to go up and over them. And the really odd thing about the impact of dams on salmon is that an awful lot of thought has gone into getting fish up and over them, and very little thought has ever gotten into how you get the little fish back down past them, even though if you get the adults up but the juveniles can't make it back to the ocean, it doesn't matter that the adults made it up in the first place. You just bought one generation. So, I mean, he has an epic journey to make it back, 1,000 miles up the Columbia and Snake Rivers. These are big rivers going against the current. You've got to hug the banks because that's where the low-velocity flow is. It's a truly epic journey. But the dams don't help with that. But the really odd thing about dams is the downstream, the hard thing, the really insoluble thing in a way, is the downstream journey for the little fish.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a picture in the book. I'm trying to dig it up now. I think it's on page 150 and 151. But it's a couple of here it is right here, and the caption is "Squeezing milt from Chinook male salmon to fertilize eggs at Big White Salmon Station in Washington State, circa 1920." I mean, just this picture of doing that. I mean, not exactly my idea of a good gig. First of all, second of all, can you imagine in 1920 what Indian people would say with something that kind of process? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, I can't give you insight into what they might say, although I'm sure they would be kind of scratching their head and wondering, what are these guys doing? The whole idea of using hatcheries to support salmon runs is one that was probably more controversial from the start than most people realize.
Now we're back to one of the 4-H's.
We're back to one of the 4-H's, the hatchery age. It's the idea that basically we could take juvenile salmon, we could squeeze fish, get their sperm, get their eggs, mix them together, make fertilized eggs, grow the eggs, and protect those eggs from predators, from all the things that might kill them in their natural environment, where most of the eggs do die before they turn into adult fish. Only a couple adult fish come back for 1,000 eggs. So the idea was that if you protect the young, we'll get more fish back in the end. The problem is that even from the start, some people were arguing, well, maybe you're just rearranging when the fish die, because if you protect fish when they're young and they don't know about predators, they're not good at finding their own food, the whole sort of natural selection argument about why the most fit fish would be the ones that survived gets circumvented. And so what we've really found historically are that by trying to produce fish with hatcheries, we don't really end up making more fish. What we do is we end up trading wild fish for hatchery fish. So fish that were sort of like free-range cattle that, you know, fed themselves, fended for themselves, didn't cost much to produce, they're now dependent. The hatchery runs are dependent on a continued technological maintenance, or they will crash because they're not adapted, well-adapted behaviorally. And they're not selected for the sharpest, best fish that were in the wild runs.
Now, you know, we can look at these stories like Lonesome Larry, that one sockeye that made it up in 1992, and we could say this is a funny story, and the way you write it, it's very funny. But if you take this in the context of native people, I mean, who depended on salmon for their physical, and some would suggest their spiritual nourishment, it's just got to be the most heartbreaking story that was ever written. And you talk in the book a little bit about the legacy of the Bureau of Indian Affairs working in conjunction with entities like the state of Washington to actually discourage salmon fishing by native peoples. You also talk about historic waterfalls where tremendous runs have happened, totally destroyed by the implementation of hydropower dams. Tell us about this.
The waterfall they're referring to is Salilo Falls on the Columbia River, where it was a natural constriction where the Columbia flowed through the Cascades. It was a constriction where salmon would have to run through, and there's a huge Native American fishing industry that, you know, caught several million salmon a year. Maybe 5-10% of the native runs were caught, traded up and down the Columbia River. There was a really vibrant regional economy in the salmon trade pre-contact times. That waterfall is now beneath, I think it's the Dalles Dam, on the Columbia, and there was actually documents from the federal agencies involved in dam propositions at the time who basically argued that building the dams would help save the salmon because the Native Americans were like catching so many of them on the Columbia that this would undo that fishing pressure. And they're kind of, in hindsight, you know, horrendously sort of shocking social documents. But it gives insight into the thinking at the time, whereas sort of dams were good, fishing was bad.
Or at least the jivey line of smoke that they were trying to blow somewhere, right?
That one could certainly view it that way. Mm-hmm. The other kind of thing with the Bureau of Indian Affairs early in the 1900s that one can point to is that there was a very strong philosophy of trying to get Native Americans to become farmers, because that's what all good Americans should be, are farmers. And I have nothing against farmers. Part of my family comes from farmers. But the philosophy was to keep them from fishing for salmon because there was a commercial industry that was developing that was competing with them for salmon, and that then Native Americans had logically the best salmon fishing grounds because they were here. They knew where those were. Never mind, they were protected by treaty rights, but there's a very sort of, I think, not malicious, but horrendously misguided effort to turn them into farmers.
Well, the notion that, there's not going to be a future in this because we've got canneries going, so don't bother with this, but we could really use some farmers because, after all, you're used to getting paid nothing, and that's what kind of a farming is. Look at the migrant farm workers, you know, in that kind of situation. You could see the logic behind it, though from another perspective it might be seen as twisted.
Yeah, I would say that the logic was that's what the social model of how one progressed was from gathering to farming, and that it flowed from that non-maliciously, but in a way that was very counterproductive for the native communities.